I want to start the talk in prayer. Okay? So, in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Heavenly Father, we ask that you would pour down upon us the grace and the gift of your Holy Spirit to kindle in our hearts the fire of your love and illuminate our minds with the light of your truth, so that in all things we may be docile to your Spirit in the imitation of your Son, to the glory of your name. Amen. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Okay. I want to begin by painting a portrait of four brown undergrads who make a pact. And their pact is that after graduation, they are going to engage in the hard work of social justice. So, since I'm not going to go into a whole bunch of detail, think of it more like a silhouette than a portrait. Our first brown undergrad, Randall. Randall, upon graduation, moves to Guatemala. And while he's serving and ministering in Guatemala, he decides that he's going to start a nonprofit organization that has the unique purpose of raising money to purchase fincas. So in Guatemala, they have this finca system, which a finca is a plantation. And so it's a very large plot of land. And the idea of the nonprofit is to raise money to purchase fincas in order to then redistribute the land to the indigenous Maya. Because if you don't know a lot about the history of Guatemala, for hundreds of years, the indigenous Maya have been treated as, at best, indentured servants on these plantations, on these finca. And in many cases, their status is little more than that of slavery. So the idea of the nonprofit is to purchase back this land and redistribute it to the indigenous Maya in order to empower them and give them a sense of dignity. Randall meets with widespread success. Our next silhouette is Ingrid. So Ingrid takes a little bit of a different tact. Ingrid becomes a lawyer. And initially, she becomes a lawyer because she wants to use the legal profession in order to fulfill this pact, to work for social justice. But slowly, she finds herself focusing more and more on things like professional development, making money, winning important cases. And eventually, Ingrid takes and wins a high-profile case that results in the overturning of an executive order that unjustly restricts immigration. She did it for the fame, but she did it nonetheless. Our third silhouette, a second guy, and so we've got Randall, we've got Ingrid. Let's name our third Albert. Albert, upon graduation, gets into local politics. And he has a special zeal for education reform. And particularly what he's got an eye towards is bridging the achievement gap. And particularly the achievement gap in his city, which has a huge distinction between the haves and the have-nots. Albert works just as hard as Randall and fails. By the end of his career, Albert has nothing to show for his work. Our last silhouette is of Ursula. Ursula gets a PhD and teaches, but she doesn't really do anything notable or even really try. She recycles, and she's environmentally conscious when it comes to purchasing. And she does have a great love for the environment. But she just never gets around to effecting anything like structural change. So we've got Randall, Ingrid, Albert, and Ursula. Who fulfilled the pact? who accomplished the work of social justice? I think if you did a survey of normal people who are engaged in either thinking through or living out the work of social justice, most people would give as a kind of standard answer, who fulfilled the pact? Randall, our first guy, right? Who created the nonprofit organization to buy back the fincas and redistribute the land. They'd say Randall, and they'd say Ingrid, the lawyer, who was actually able to win that high-profile case in order to bring a little bit of justice to the question of immigration. And I think most people would say that Albert, who, despite a life of fighting for these things, who never really accomplished anything, and Ursula, who, you know, did marginal, small, little things, but never really worked for or accomplished structural changes, they would say Albert and Ursula failed. That's the standard answer. But there's a problem with it. And here, the problem is not so much a theoretical problem as an existential one. What's wrong with the standard answer? The vast majority of us are not and never will be Randalls or Ingrids. The vast majority of us are Alberts and Ursulas. We either try to effect these widespread structural changes and fail, or we don't really shoot for that. So, if most of us are Alberts and Ursulas, it seems like most of us will need to throw up our hands and admit defeat and just embrace despair when it comes to the project of social justice. Because the task is too big. The project is too challenging. And so, there's no hope. The point of this talk is to deny that inference. The point of this talk is to insist that we do not need to despair, and that every last one of us, regardless of our state or condition in life, can and should hope to engage in a rich, life-giving, fruitful effort of social justice. The question is how. So, what I want to insist is that the position of despair comes from two things. First, it comes from having a consequentialist understanding of social justice, and we'll get more into that a little bit later, and it comes from having a reductivist understanding of social justice. So, consequentialism and reductivism. These are the things that will lead us ultimately to despair, or will lead the vast majority of us to despair of the work of social justice. So this talk is intended to give us hope by shifting those two perspectives. So first, let's make that initial shift, and this has to do with the ethical framework. So what's the ethical perspective we're adopting when we come to the work of social justice? And this is the right place to start, because any talk of justice presupposes a framework of ethics, right? To speak about justice is to speak about right and wrong, good and bad in the moral sphere. And so it's impossible for us to approach issues of social justice without first adopting an ethical perspective. So, we need ethics in order to approach social justice, but what ethics do we need? Broadly speaking, we can think of three general approaches to ethics, three ethical frameworks. Something that's called a deontological ethics, something that's called consequentialist ethics, and something that's called character ethics, or sometimes it's also referred to as virtue ethics. We're not going to talk about deontological ethics today. We're going to focus on consequentialist and character-based ethics. And there are two kind of reasons for this. One is just because we don't have time to tackle all three. But the second is because when it comes to the unique question of social justice, most people approach social justice and these issues from a consequentialist perspective. And I want to suggest shifting to a character-based perspective. So, what do each of these mean? First, the kind of standard answer that says that that Randall and Ingrid are our social justice successes, that standard answer comes from having a consequentialist approach. So consequentialism is a normative theory of ethics. So it's a theory that really does say, look, there are rules and guiding principles that we can and should invoke that are going to have normative force, right? They're going to have, they're going to be universally applicable to give us a sense of morality that can apply to everyone. So it is a normative approach to ethics, but consequentialism is a normative approach to ethics that focuses on the effects of an action. So from this moral philosophy, the main question is, what does this action do? What are the consequences of engaging in this kind of action or refraining from this kind of action? So consequences, consequentialism. And consequentialism is focused on the overall effects of the action. And usually what this means is it means we're asking about external communal effects. So one of the great expressions of a consequentialist ethics is utilitarianism. And so the greatest happiness principle within a utilitarian ethical model says that that action is best or is good, which promotes the greatest happiness for the greatest number. And how is happiness understood? Happiness is usually understood in terms of external effects. So, in this kind of consequentialist approach, the task of moral philosophy is to examine an action and anticipate its results. And once you've anticipated the results, then you sort of gather them together, all the pros and all the cons, and you weigh the whole heaping pile. And you see, does this action leave us in the red or in the black? Is there net gain or net loss when it comes to consequences? That's consequentialist ethics. Character-based ethics is something very different. So like consequentialism, it is a normative ethical theory. So we're laying down general principles, universal guidelines that are going to apply to everyone and can actually prescribe things to be done and things to be avoided. Unlike consequentialist ethics, character-based ethics is not primarily focused on the effects of an action. Instead, we're focused on the character of a person. So where consequentialism is focused on deeds, and primarily external, outward, visible deeds, and the consequences that they have, virtue ethics, or character-based ethics, is focused on what sort of person you are. So in this approach, it's more important that you be a good person than that you do a good deed. it's more important that you be a good person than that you do a good deed. So, do character or virtue ethicists talk about actions? Yes, absolutely. But they talk about actions in light of character or virtue. So, actions are evaluated on this model by asking the question, what sort of person does this action shape me into? So, if you repeatedly engage in the act of lying, after enough practice, it's going to shape you into being a liar, right? But I think intuitively, we all recognize that there's a difference between being a liar and telling a lie, right? Just because I slipped up under pressure and told a lie in this particular moment, here and now, it doesn't mean I'm a liar. Being a liar has to do not just with actions, but with dispositions, right? Liars are people who are prone to tell lies, people who are disposed to tell lies. They're like runners prepped on the starting line waiting for the gun to go off, right? They're quick off the block to lie. That's what vice is actually about. Vice is the sort of interior disposition of a person towards bad action. The flip side of that is that virtue is an interior disposition that preps and gears a person to good action. So the difference between someone who engages in a good action and someone who has that virtue is that the virtuous person doesn't merely engage in the good action or the virtuous action, right, like telling the truth. The virtuous person tells the truth promptly, easily, and joyfully. Why? Because that's the sort of person they are, right? Telling the truth is just second nature to them. It's part of their character. And so the virtue ethics approach says, or the character-based ethics approach, says that the primary task for the person trying to live the moral life is become a good person. Build good character. And then actions are going to become a really important part in that project of building good character, of becoming a good person. So where consequentialism focuses on the effects of an action, virtue ethics focuses on the character of a person. So there's a shift in the focus or the emphasis there. Now, what does any of this have to do with social justice, right? Because that's actually the point of the talk. Most people, when thinking through social justice and when engaging in social acts of social justice, the work of social justice, the project of social justice, most people take a consequentialist approach, which means all of us are sort of predisposed to think of the work of social justice as primarily focused on outward effects, results, right? Do you get results? And so notice, Ingrid and Randall were the two, right? The guy who makes the nonprofit organization to buy up Finkaland and redistribute it, and Ingrid, the lawyer, who wins the case to overturn the executive order, those are the people that get results. So it's a kind of ambient assumption in most people's approach to the question, to questions and issues of social justice, that we're approaching this from a consequentialist perspective, which means what we're worried about is the bottom line, Do you get the results or do you not? But I want to propose that we can take a character-based approach to social justice. And I want to suggest that that's actually the more enriching and life-giving way to think about and engage in the work of social justice. What would this sort of an approach look like or require? It would mean that our primary question in tackling the task of social justice is not what results do I get, but am I becoming a socially just person? Right? The issue primarily here is not shaping, changing, and transforming the outward world. It's about shaping, changing, and transforming me, the human heart. Am I the kind of person who promptly, easily, and joyfully engages in works of justice? And the real task of social justice is to shape myself and everyone I come into contact with into that sort of person. That's what a character-based approach to social justice will look like. So are we going to worry about actions? Absolutely we are. Are we going to worry about external structures? Absolutely we are. Right? So you're going to try to change external structures that are unjust. But why? Not because you're looking for an outward bottom line, but because you recognize that the real task of justice, the real task of ethics, is to change hearts. That's the task. So, I said we need to make two shifts in perspective in order to really grasp and gain a position of hope for the work of social justice. The first shift in perspective was this shift in ethical framework from consequentialism to a character-based ethics or a virtue ethics. The second shift that needs to happen is a shift in thinking about justice itself. So how do we understand justice? The word justice, especially in common usage, is actually pretty vague, right? So I get the opportunity over at Providence College to work with a lot of service organizations. And so concretely, kind of where the rubber hits the road, I'm working with students who are engaged in social justice. Very few of them are able to give a good account of what justice is in general, let alone what social justice is actually all about. They have a kind of vague understanding, a sort of provisional understanding, a working kind of grasp of what they're up to. But if you actually stop and ask them, what's social justice all about? Oftentimes, they're groping in the dark. And I don't think they're unique in this. I think most people who are engaged in the work rarely take time to step back and reflect on what it is they're actually doing and what it is they're actually up to. So few can offer a good definition, and I think that's especially true of social justice. So, just to show that I'm not like making all this up, here are two kind of what I would take to be representative different attempts at defining social justice. So I'll start with one that comes from a very popular source, and then I'll move to one that comes from an academic source. So if you go on Wikipedia and read the Wikipedia article on social justice, here's the definition that you're going to find. Social justice is the fair and just relation between the individual and society. Social justice is the fair and just relation between individual and society. Okay. From a more academic source, this is G.J. Papagiorgio, who wrote a piece called Social Values and Social Justice. He says, although it's difficult to agree on the precise meaning of social justice, I take it that to most of us it implies, among other things, equality of the burdens, the advantages, and the opportunities of citizenship. Equality of the burdens, the advantages, and the opportunities of citizenship. Both of those definitions, the kind of more popular one and the more academic one, both of those definitions involve a kind of deep-seated ambiguity. Both of them are getting at a sense of relationship. The popular definition specifies, right? It's a relationship between individual and society. And that relationship is implied in Papagiorgiou's discussion of equality of burdens, advantages, and opportunities of citizenship, right? So there, he's inviting us to think of the individual citizen as part of a whole, right? As part of society. The idea of citizenship kind of connects both notions. Okay, so we've got this understanding that there's some kind of relationship between part and whole, between individual and community. But it's not really clear in those two definitions what that relationship is. So when we work for social justice, we're working to bring justice into that relationship, but it's ambiguous how. Okay, Aquinas to the rescue, right? So when St. Thomas talks about justice, and he spends a lot of time talking about justice, he's drawing on a long and rich tradition of philosophical ethical reflection. So it's rooted in a text written by Aristotle called the Nicomachean Ethics, but that text gets adopted, commented on, enriched, and transformed in the later Greek and classical Arabic traditions. And then it's that Greco-Arabic tradition that Aquinas inherits and riffs upon. So when Aquinas tackles questions of justice, he's got a lot of reflection to draw upon, which means he's got a lot of philosophical tools in his toolkit. So he can bring a kind of precision where oftentimes our contemporary reflection is vague. So first, let's just talk about justice in general. And remember, we're looking at a character-based approach to justice. So justice is the virtue, there's your character forming, right? Justice is the virtue that disposes us to render to each what is due. The virtue that disposes us to render to each what is due, right? So to give what's owed. Wherever it's owed. The just person is the person who, like the runner waiting for the gun to go off, right, is primed and ready to promptly, easily, and joyfully give to another person what's owed to that person. And if you point to someone like that, someone with that kind of character, you're pointing to a just person. So, social justice from this character-based or virtue ethics approach is going to be about instilling that kind of disposition in the human heart, right? Fostering that sort of virtue where we are ready to give what's owed to another person as if it were second nature. But what about the social part of the social justice, right? Like, if that's justice in general, we need to give a definition of social justice. And here, that character-based or virtue ethics approach actually has a long-standing tradition of saying there are three kinds of justice that each, in their own way, render what is due or owed to another person. And so to explain this kind of triple relationship of justice, I get to use chalk, which is one of my favorite things ever. So, draw a triangle. At the top of the triangle, you have the community. At each of the bottom two points of the triangle, you have, we'll just call it a private party. So usually this is an individual. So you have private party, community. When we think of it like this, we can articulate three different sorts of relationships. There's the relationship between private party and private party. There's the relationship between community and private party. And then there's the relationship between private party and community. So you flip around the order there. For St. Thomas Aquinas, each one of these relationships constitutes a unique sort of relationship of justice. So, the private party to private party one, this is what's called commutative justice. So it has to do with the word commutation, which means an exchange. And this is the one that comes naturally to us, right? So if I go to a coffee shop and I want to buy a cup of coffee, I'm engaging in exchange, in commutation. And in order for our transaction to be just, I need to give what is owed to the barista, and the barista needs to give what is owed to me. So, I need to give a certain amount of cash in order to get a certain amount of coffee. And here, what's going to make something just or fair is perfect equality, right? I need to give exactly the amount of money that the coffee is worth. So if it's a $2 cup of coffee, I need to give $2. And if I give $1.50, he's going to wait until I find 50 more cents. Why? Because I haven't given what's due unless our exchange is equalized, right? And you can think way, way, way back to something like a barter system, right? If I'm a shoemaker and you're a saddle maker, I need to exchange an equal number of pair of shoes as the worth of the saddle. So the relationship needs to be equalized. That's commutative justice. This one, where you start with the private party and you think, what does the private party owe to the community? That's going to be a different kind of justice. And when you think, what does the community owe to the private party? That's going to be a different kind of justice. When we start top down, community to individual, this is what's called distributive justice. So distributive justice is about how do we distribute common goods. And so my favorite example of this is in a household. Let's say there's only one wedge of cake left. And there are two boys. Both boys want a piece of cake. And so mom or dad has to cut that last wedge. How do you cut the wedge? If your answer is exactly equally, you're probably wrong. Unless they're twins. If one of the boys is 2 years old and one of the boys is 18 years old, you're guaranteed that mom or dad is going to cut a very small sliver for the two-year-old and is going to give the rest to the 18-year-old. Why? Because what's fair and just, according to distributive justice, is not what's equal, it's what's proportionate. Right? So you give in proportion to the need, or you give in proportion to the desire, you give in proportion to the merit, something like that. So when someone who has care for the community, like parents have care for a household, are going about the task of distributing or redistributing the goods that belong to the community, the common goods, the way that you fairly, equitably, and justly do that is not by equalizing, it's by proportionalizing, right? There's a wonderful story about two twin boys who the way that their parents did this cake thing is they had two moves. So one of the boys was allowed to cut the cake. The other of the boys was allowed to pick the first slice. So he was getting out the protractor to make sure that's equal, right? So notice what just happened, right? When it's private party to private party, they want to equalize, right? The protractor comes out and they slice that cake as exactly perfectly in half as they can. Because when private party deals with private party, you want equality. When mom or dad distributes the cake, they don't. They distribute it as needed, right? Proportionately. Now, this is really important because most people today who approach questions of social justice do it reductively. So remember I said there are two perspectives that we need to shift, the consequentialist perspective and the reductivist perspective. Most people today, and most people not intentionally, right? It's just kind of the ambient culture of social justice work today. Reduce social justice to distributive justice. They say social justice is just a question of how do we equitably distribute or redistribute, say, the land involved in finca plantations? How do we distribute governmental funding? Those kinds of questions are questions of distributive justice. And most people today reduce social justice to certain issues of distributive justice. So there are lots of things like, say, mom or dad's cutting a piece of cake. That's an example of distributive justice. Most people would not say that's social justice, right? So most people today reduce social justice to distributive justice that has to do with certain issues, like education, gender equality, race and ethnicity, those kinds of things. So it's this reductivist account. I want to propose something different by looking at the as yet unmentioned third relationship of justice. This kind of justice isn't about what the community owes to the individual. And it's not about what one individual owes to another individual. It asks the question of, what does the individual owe to the community? What does the individual owe to the community? And the best quotable quote to capture this kind of justice is JFK. Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask rather what you can do for your country. That is this kind of justice. That's this sort of relationship. It's when the individual person is disposed to give what is due to the greater good, to the larger community. And that comes in a lot of different kinds, right? Because there's not just one overarching community that we're embedded in. Actually, every single one of us, as individual human beings, is simultaneously embedded in a whole host of different communities. Many of you are embedded in the community here at Brown. More narrowly, some of you are embedded in the Catholic community here at Brown. But larger, we're embedded in the community of Providence, the community of Rhode Island, the community of the United States of America, the global community. We are simultaneously members, citizens, right, to get back to that, the more academic of those two definitions of social justice. We are citizens, we are members of multiple communities, layers of communities that intersect and penetrate one another in complicated and complicating ways. But if that's true, and we're all members of these communities, then we can all ask this question. What do I owe to that community? How can I do right by that community? How can I serve the good of that community? And it turns out the good of a community is the common good. And now we're hitting language that's all over the place in social justice work, right? Whether you're talking about education reform, whether you're talking anything, all of it, people always will talk about the common good or the greater good. Turns out that language is really reflective of this relationship. To ask about how can we, in our life and activity, serve the greater good is asking a question about this. And so I want to suggest that if we make that first shift from a consequentialist ethics to a virtue-based or character-based ethics, we also make a parallel shift and we actually think of this as social justice. So social justice is the form of justice where an individual is disposed, right, has the virtue of promptly, easily, and joyfully rendering what is due to the community or communities that he or she is a part of. And if someone has that kind of interior disposition, where it's just second nature to them to act in a way that serves and benefits the common good, that is a socially just person. So, this lets us actually have hope. Right? So the last thing I want to say is just a few words on social justice and the human heart. Because if we make both of these switches, if we think of justice from a virtue-based approach, a character-based approach, where the question is transforming hearts and not merely structures, and we add that what all of this language of serving the common good is actually about is this kind of relationship where we are working for the good of a community, for the common good, by rendering what's due to that community, then it turns out we have a whole lot of reason to hope that no matter what our state in life, no matter what our material conditions may be, we can all engage fruitfully and in a life-giving way in the work of social justice. Because it turns out that this relationship can actually embrace every single human action. So where the reductivist approach to social justice would make it, would limit it to working for merely for distributive justice in certain key areas or on certain key issues, this lets us realize that actually every single action in our entire lives could potentially be an act of social justice. Why? Because every action I engage in, I can engage in for the sake of the greater good. I can ask, right, how giving this lecture will actually serve and benefit the communities that I'm a part of. I can ask how something simple, right? Think of Ursula, right? She was the one who, I mean, didn't really do anything like flashy or spectacular or notable, you know, but she did, like, she bought a hybrid and she did it on purpose because, you know, she's worried about her carbon footprint and all of that. That's an act of social justice. At least if we broaden our horizon and if we change our perspectives, that's an act of social justice. Because why did she forego the pickup? Because in her own little small way, she recognizes that by buying a hybrid, she can do some small action that will serve the greater good. Think about poor old Albert. Right? Poor Albert worked hard to bring about educational reform in his local political community. And he failed. Is he a social justice failure because he wasn't able to bring about external effects, right? Because his actions seem to bear no consequence in the world around him? No. He is not a failure when it comes to social justice. Why? Because every single one of those attempts that he made to change the educational structure in his local community, even though it didn't bear outward fruit, it did bear inward fruit. It changed the kind of person that he is. It shaped his interior character. And for the virtue ethicist, for a character-based approach, that matters. So it doesn't matter that he didn't seem to succeed in a worldly sense of success. He engaged in a profound and beautiful way in a lifelong work of social justice. And what does he have to show for it? His own beautiful person. The fact that he has become a good man who desires to give what is due to the greater community. And that's a beautiful thing. So who achieved social justice, really? Who fulfilled the terms of their agreement on graduating at Brown? Randall did, with his work with the Fincas. And, you know, so he was able to change outward structures. And why? For the greater good. For the larger community that he's a part of. And that's why he strives to change those structures. Because changing the structures is good for the community. It's not that it's a form of distributive justice. It's because it's good for the community. From the perspective of the government, it's distributive justice. But from the perspective of Randall, it's social justice. It's working for the greater good. But, like I just said, Albert also, despite his lack of outward success, engaged in social justice. So did Ursula, right? In her own tiny, little, small ways, in those little actions that are so easy to ignore or pass over. Just because she wasn't changing the world in big, flashy, showy ways doesn't mean that she wasn't engaging in social justice. She was. Because every time she recycled, every time she made an environmentally conscious purchase, she was doing it for the sake of serving the community that she's a part of. And that's what social justice is all about. So, do you need to despair of not being able to engage in social justice just because you may not produce widespread societal structural change? No, you do not need to despair. Because this new approach, this new perspective, opens up the horizon and the possibility for doing social justice to everyone, everywhere. So thank you, Thomas Aquinas. And that's my lecture. Questions? Yeah?
Can you talk about the relationship between the three different kinds of justice? Because mm-hmm. when you were talking about the commutative kind of justice, mm-hmm. I was thinking about the coffee example you gave. Mm-hmm. What if the coffee place was like, you know what, we're going to charge $5 for this, mm-hmm. and we know that it's overpriced. So, like, there has to be agreement that a price is just, or else it won't happen. And I'm just thinking a lot in terms of, you know, things like oil companies or mm-hmm. even like airline ticketing, where mm-hmm. so much of it is relative based on like people trying to get money. So if that commutative justice doesn't really happen as much, how would it affect the ability for private parties to participate in the social justice that's on the left-hand side?
That's all in this one?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Okay, yeah, that's a great question. There's a lot going on there. So first, there's the question of, is company X setting a just price for product Y, right? And that is, that's going to depend on what perspective we're taking. So if you take the perspective of, say, the global community, right? So the bigger community, then it's possible that the answer is no, they're not setting a just price, right? Because the... This is actually why I put it as private party as opposed to individual, right? So even companies can function as private parties, right? So when one private party is contracting with or competing with another private party, right, that competition, at least in a kind of like in a classically liberal sort of laissez-faire economic sense, that competition between private party and private party is going to determine what the right price is, right? But if you've got a case where you've got the company dealing with lots of individuals that it has that are kind of beneath it, then you could end up getting something like this, right? The company is standing in the position of the community, and the individuals are beneath it. This is what happens when you get into questions of just wage, right? So just wage, the company is the community that you're a part of, and the individual is the private party, right? How much does the company pay? That's a question of distributive justice, right? So just wage. When it comes to me grappling with, like, the coffee company, right? That actually does end up being a private party to private party. So here the private party is an individual, me, and over here the private party is the company. Because if I don't actually agree that, like, I mean, look, like, that is such an overpriced cup of coffee, I just don't buy it, right? So I judge that that cup of coffee is more expensive than I'm willing to pay. Because remember, what constitutes justice in commutative, in the commutative relationship? It's equalization between the two parties. So the two parties are the ones that determine whether or not it's just or not. So that now I might gripe about it, but I'm not really saying it's unjust, right? If I purchase the cup of coffee, I've given my assent and said, yeah, okay, fine, to me, here and now, I will pay $5 for that cup of coffee. So I might say this is so unjust, but in a strict sense, that's not actually what I mean. If I genuinely thought it was an unjust price, I wouldn't buy it. Does that kind of make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So you've got lots of questions of, like, what position on the triangle the individual people are taking up. So if you're talking about questions of just wage, it's likely distributive justice. If you're talking about just agreeing to buy something or not, then you're talking about commutative justice. And then how would it relate to social justice? That was the second part of your question. So it could relate to social justice in a couple different ways, but it's a lot of it is going to have to do with the intention of the buyer, right? So, for example, let's say I go to Shenandoah Joe's, which is a really, really wonderful coffee place that that buys their coffee free trade, right? So it's free trade coffee, and they're very conscious about what's going, like, what are the stages involved in getting this coffee to Shenandoah Joe's, and is there any injustice going on or exploitation of workers going on at any point in that process? They go out of their way to make sure that that's the case, that that's not the case. And I go out of my way to make sure that I go to Shenandoah Joe's and not to Starbucks. Yeah, that's social justice, right? If the reason why I'm going to buy my coffee from them is at least partially because I recognize that going there as opposed to going somewhere else will serve the greater good, will benefit, like, the human community, even if I don't personally know those people, then yeah, that act is an act of practicing social justice. And the more I do things like that, the more I engage in socially conscious purchasing practices, the more it's going to shape my character. So even in buying coffee, you can be engaged in social justice. Yeah.
So we talk about how the community of justice is distributed, or I guess distributed is the right word, based on equality.
Mm-hmm.
And distributive justice
is fair or just,
yeah,
right?
It's fair or just based on equality.
Mm-hmm.
Distributive justice is fair or just based on
proportion. Mm-hmm.
What is the equivalent for social justice? Is it also proportional, or is there another, I guess, paradigm?
Yeah. No, that's a great question. So, so in certain cases, it can be equality. In certain cases, it can be proportion. But by and large, this one, you actually can't engage in perfect justice. Because remember, the definition of perfect justice, right, like the real rigorous definition of justice, is rendering to each what is due, right? How do I give an account of what I owe to my country? How do I quantify what I owe to the global human community? And, I mean, I would just throw this out there, right? Because so St. Thomas Aquinas was a fantastic philosopher. He was also, I mean, and primarily a theologian, right? So when we shift musical keys and we shift from the key of philosophy into the key of theology, we can recognize that there's actually a larger community than even the global human community, right? There's the community that is the church, right? There's the community that binds us together and knits us into one family as sons and daughters of God and, you know, brothers and sisters with the saints and angels in heaven, right? So how do you give an account of what is owed or due to that? You can't. Not really. And so you do your best, right? Which is part of the rhetorical genius of JFK, right? Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. That's a blank check. I could never do enough for my country. And so since I can't do enough, I do what I can. Which means the horizon of social justice action is usually going to be limitless, right? There's always more that we can do. But precisely the opposite of giving us reason to despair, this should actually give us reason to hope, right? Because the goal here, the focus here, is not on the results and what I get done, but rather it's on the action and the endeavor as changing and transforming me. And that project is never done.
So then, at a minimum, it is to do what our community asks of us directly,
mm-hmm. right.
and in some ways indirectly. And then, well, at a maximum, it's, you know, a total gift.
Yeah, there's kind of no maximum there, right? So there's sort of no maximum, but at a minimum, yeah, I think you're exactly right. There are certain things that the community asks of us, right? So the community that is the United States of America asks us to pay our taxes. You know, the community of a household, right? Usually mom and dad lay down kind of ground rules. And often, and here's the reality is, usually we don't need those expectations or rules to be made explicit. Because if you're embedded in a community, if you're really living in a community and with these people, you know what's expected of you. And you can foster a spirit and an attitude and a heart that wants to do that, and more importantly, that wants to go above and beyond. Right? And those are the ones who are really contributing to their community. It's just that contribution doesn't have to be measured in external consequences or effects. Yeah?
You've spoken about how we're embedded in multiple communities at the same time. What would you say of the person who easily, promptly, and joyfully contributes to the good of certain communities to which he or she belongs, but not others, where he might, say, be indifferent to the good of his country in preference to his local community?
Mm-hmm.
Or any example you want. Is that person socially just or not, or kind of?
Oh, so that's a great question. A very quick, just kind of big schematic thing for this sort of virtue ethics or character-based ethics approach. In that, I mentioned that sort of kind of big tent, sort of Aristotelian tradition that includes not just Aristotle's thought, but later Greek and Arabic thinkers that then gets translated into the Latin West. They often think about things, when they ask what is something, they'll think of it as a genus, which is like an overarching kind or a type of thing that then has within it species. So you can think of hominid is a genus, and then Homo sapiens is a species falling under the genus hominid, right? You can think of a characteristic is a genus, and then one kind or type or species of characteristic is a virtue, right? A vice would be a different one, right? So social justice, when we're looking here, social justice is a species of justice, right? So you've got justice that then divides into these three kinds, right? Social, commutative, I'm just going to dot that, and distributive, right? Turns out, so from this perspective, genus is up here, species is down here. Turns out, all of these can actually be considered genuses that have species falling under them. So for every community that you're a part of, there's going to be a different specific virtue that you can build or not that's going to build in you that unique type of social justice. And every time you build a given type of social justice, it's going to help build the more generic virtue of social justice in general. So, if you have someone who is deeply invested in the well-being of their local community, that person is probably going to have, in a deep sense, the local community virtue of social justice. But, as you mentioned, it's certainly possible to have that in a really like robust, rigorous sense, and not have the specific virtue of social justice that disposes us to give what's due to our nation, right? Or what's due to the broader human community. So you can kind of think of them like springs, right? So the more you press a spring in, kind of the more energy it's got, and the faster it's going to spring out as soon as you let it go. So if each of these versions of social justice is its own spring, then they might have one where there's a whole lot of tension and it's ready to go, and the other one that's kind of flimsy, right? So is that person socially just? Well, yeah, in one respect. Is that person socially just in another? Well, they might have more work to do. And so how do we build the sort of general justice or general virtue of social justice, broadly speaking? We try to maximize and actualize all forms of social justice, which means, and this is a really kind of neat thing that didn't come out in the talk, it's another compelling reason for taking the virtue-based or character-based approach, because it means that if you want to be socially just in a robust sense, it's not enough for you to just silo in on your one little issue and work on just that and nothing else. Because the best that that's going to be able to do is fostering you a kind of imperfect sense of the general virtue of social justice. To really be, I mean, if you want to point to someone who's a paragon of social justice, what you're going to be pointing to is someone who has fostered and built and nurtured all of those specific forms of social justice. They're going to be the real deal, the whole package. Yeah?
So I guess to follow up on that question, so what we're talking about, I guess how our own distribution, how we distribute justice to our various communities we involve with, is it kind of like a reverse subsidiarity principle we could apply?
Give me a little bit more.
So let's say, for example,
because remember, distribution is this one,
what,
right?
Yeah. So what
so individuals time? Don't distribute.
Well,
it's individuals who have care for a community.
I'm thinking, so back to the before case we talked about. So I'm thinking, Randall, he's down in Guatemala. He's doing great work for the indigenous community, but at the same time, he say neglects his own family. Where, I mean, I think most of us on a kind of, you know, visceral level would see that, you know, he's not a very just person. He's doing this great work for people that are maybe, you know, in relationship, you know, further removed from him, but the people that are closest to him, he is doing great injustice to.
Yeah, that's
so,
a great...
What's
going on there?
What's going on there?
Yeah, sure. So we've done the thing that scholastics like most, which is we've made distinctions. So for Randall, what he owes to the individual members of his family is either going to be a form of commutative justice, depending on what we're talking about, or it's going to be distributive justice. Right, so insofar as Randall is like a father and has care of kind of overarching, has care of the family community, there are certain things that he needs to distribute from the common goods there. But like playing with his kids, that's commutative justice, right? Fathers owe it to their children to play with them. And children have a right to expect that their fathers will play with them, right? So, is he unjust? Well, in that particular species of commutative justice, yes, he's being unjust. Is he unjust with respect to social justice and what he's owing to the larger community of, say, like the human family or the Guatemalan people or specifically the indigenous Maya, right? No, he's very just in that respect. And so what your example is highlighting is something that I think is existentially really important. From a theological perspective, I'm going to put on my theologian's hat for a second. From a theological perspective, there's existential umph to the doctrine of divine simplicity, right? So there is one and only one being that is perfectly, utterly, radically simple, and that's God. The rest of us are complicated messes, right? So our complexity, our messiness, easily spills over into the moral life, right? So the vast majority of us, for the entirety of our lives, are big, messy works in progress, right? Which means there are ways in which I've been formed well, but there are ways in which I'm still kind of yucky, nasty, unformed, wet clay. And so in the example that you gave, you know, with regard to what he owes to his family, he's kind of failing. With regard to what he can do to serve the common good of the Guatemalan people, he's doing well, right? And it shouldn't perturb us if our understanding of ethics and our approach to moral philosophy actually has room to recognize that both of those can be true at the same time. That should actually be a point in favor of the system. Yeah.
Shouldn't there be like a hierarchy of like obligations that play here, right?
it just seems like if you've chosen to be a father, or if that's sort of like what's in your life, and that sort of takes precedence over whether or not you're helping distribute lands to the mines. I mean, that seems intuitive to me. You can't like spell out exactly why, maybe just because there's a hard, like there's a natural right there for
mm-hmm.
your children, whereas like the good you're doing for the indigenous people is like a superogatory sort of like you're taking on an extra obligation.
Mm-hmm.
That's very good. But it wouldn't exactly be wrong for you not to do it if you didn't. It's just maybe given who you are, you did have that kind of access, so you feel like you're the only person that could. But you're the only father that those kids actually have, because the children only have one father.
Yeah, you are exactly right. So so actually, one, a really, really, really standard example in distinguishing between a virtue ethics approach and or a character-based ethics approach and consequentialist ethics is something called the trolley car example. So the trolley car example goes like this. You have a trolley that's moving along the tracks, and there's a split in the tracks. On one side of the track is a group of, say, 10, 15, 20, 30 people who are all tied by some evil villain to the tracks. But that's not where the train is headed. The train is headed actually on the other side of the break, where there's only one person tied there, and it happens to be your son. And the ethical question, the moral dilemma is, can you pull the lever and in such a way that the trolley would change directions to avoid killing your son, even though you foresee that it's probably going to end up killing more people, right? On a consequentialist ethics approach, you may not pull the lever. Why? Because everything is about effects. It's about counting the consequences. And so there, you know, greatest happiness principle, utilitarianism, it's if you're going to kill more people going that route, then you can't do it. From a virtue ethics perspective, from a character ethics perspective, what that answer fails to recognize is precisely the difference in obligations or duties that and responsibilities that we have based on the intersecting networks of our relationships, and the fact that all of those different relationships bear with them different aspects of character and virtue, right? So fathers owe it, according in justice, to their children to protect them, right? This is just, it's a parental obligation that you protect your kids. And so in the interest of fulfilling that obligation and building the virtue of paternity, right? Or maternity if it's a mother, right? You can flip the lever and to save your child. And you don't have to do a kind of moral arithmetic to count the consequences there. And you're right that there is also a kind of nesting of responsibilities and obligations that yields a hierarchy. So we do owe more to certain communities than others. Now the one nuance, right, is that the higher order communities, right, the more all-encompassing, the good of the community that you're talking about, the more of a claim it has on you. So, and this is actually something that people misinterpret, well, at least Catholics will often misinterpret about the principle of subsidiarity. The broader community does have more of a claim on you than your familial community, right? In this sense, so if there were reason for a draft, your country can call on you to fight and lay down your life for your country, right? And that's actually more morally obligatory than your obligation to care for your family. However, according to distributive justice, right, if the wider community is going to call on individuals within it to give in what is an atypical way, then it's an obligation of the community, according to distributive justice, to make that possible, right? Which is why, usually and justly, you can get out of a draft if there are certain kinds of family requirements. But yeah, the higher order community does outrank the lower order community. What the principle of subsidiarity is about is not inverting that relationship. The principle of subsidiarity is about recognizing that higher order communities should respect the autonomy and integrity of lower order communities and shouldn't unnecessarily assume to themselves the tasks, functions, and activities of those lower order communities. That's subsidiarity. Yeah.
So would I be right in saying, so in that respect, a higher order community to have distributive justice asks proportionately less of its constituents than the nested lower order?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, when was the last time the human community asked us to do anything? Right. I mean, I imagine like if we were facing zombie apocalypse, right, it might happen that like all of the governments over all of the world would band together and make certain and like issue certain requests, right, about like, please, quarantine any zombie you see, right, like, something like that. Right. But I mean, even just practically speaking, the higher order you get, the harder it is for that community to actually ask things of you. I mean, to use a more concrete example, I'm a member of a pretty high order community, which is the Dominican Order, right? It's a worldwide religious order. And there actually is someone who has care for that community. His name is Father Bruno, and he's a friar from France, and he's very short, and I've met him once, and he probably doesn't know me from Adam, which makes it very unlikely that I'm going to get a call from Brother Bruno saying, like, hey, Philip Neri, how about Kenya, right? He can reassign me wherever he wants, right? And I'd actually be how our province's mission is in Kenya. And so I'd be perfectly happy to go to Nairobi. Chances are I'm not going to get called upon by the higher order community to do that, because when you're in charge of a worldwide order of Dominican friars, you're not usually spending a whole lot of time worrying about like this random visiting instructor in philosophy at Providence College. So yeah, so the lower order communities, the closer to home the community is, the more likely it's going to be to actually ask things of us on a regular daily basis. But the higher you get, the less likely. So there is a kind of shift in proportion there.
So what does that mean for our Guatemala example? Because Guatemala, or the group, didn't ask him to do it. So like, what does that mean?
Yeah?
I would like to talk about that, because Why does he do what he does? Why does he go there in Guatemala? I mean, he cannot just leave his family to go there if he's not good inside him. If there is no good inside him. So maybe how much does the family need? How much does the family ask of him?
Yeah, so I mean,
that's the question, because we can go back to the example of the cake, how you distribute it. Because he cannot just go to Guatemala if he's not a good person inside. He cannot just give to to others while denying his father.
Yeah, so I mean, there's one kind of cheap, mean way that I can get out of this, which was in the example, Randall was just an undergrad at Brown. So I could just say, like, look, Randall, like, he just graduated. He doesn't have a family yet. You know, he's not interested in, he's not there yet, right? So he's a freewheeling post-grad, right? And he's going to take a gap year, right? And he just decides that, oh, well, you know, for my gap year, I'd love to, like, backpack through Latin America. So I'm going to go down and spend some time in Guatemala. And he gets there to Guatemala. All of a sudden, he's confronted with this finca system and structures of systematic oppression that he didn't know existed. And he's taken with it. And he just says, oh, my gosh, I want to do something about this, right? You used the word, the giant word, supererogatory, so I'm going to use it back at you. So strictly speaking, right, Randall, at least upon graduation at Brown, Randall did not have an obligation to, because Randall wasn't embedded in that community. So the only way to kind of parse that is, look, Randall was doing what he was doing because he's embedded in this much broader, wider human community. And is that broader, wider human community asking him to go to Guatemala? No, right? So in that case, he's engaged in an act of social justice, right? That's also super erogatory, right? So it's not, he's not fulfilling an obligation that's being required of him. He's rendering what he decides for himself he owes to the larger human community, right? Now, if you take kind of playing with the example like we just did, and you imagine, you know, Randall goes, embeds himself in the community there in Guatemala, just as kind of like a free-spirited post-grad, but he starts making friends, right? He starts actually building relationships. He starts sharing life with the people there. Now, all of a sudden, the injustice becomes a lot more real for him, right? Now it's not just the kind of global, vague, high order community that he's thinking about. Now he's thinking about something much closer to home, right? He's thinking about his friends, right? The people that he's met, you know, the people who have shared food and table and roof with him. And now maybe you can start talking about him giving back in ways that are not super erogatory, you know? Now maybe he's sitting there thinking, holy cow, like, I have the means to change the way these people are being treated. And I know these people. I love these people. You know, I live with these people. And I'm morally obligated to help these people, right? There, we've shifted out of the realm of the supererogatory into the realm of strict justice. Thank you all very much.